Okay, good evening, everybody. This is Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and I'm really excited to have you all on the call tonight. This call is about managing pain and inflammation. I've got the call on mute right now so that we get a clean background, so that there's no background noise, so when you're listening back over this, or if anybody that's not on the call is listening to it, they won't have a lot of, you know, kitchen noise and things like that. What I will do is periodically I'm going to unmute the call so that we can have question and answer. So what I thought I would do is start out by letting everybody know what the call format is going to be. And I want to start out and have everybody get in touch with why they wanted to be on the call, and I'll take a few minutes to do a little exercise like that. And I'm going to do an introduction, and we're going to talk about pain and inflammation, and then I'm going to unmute the call for a little while. Everybody can ask questions, then I'll mute the call again, and then we'll go on and teach some more information. I figure with information like this, there's a lot of information, and there's a lot of somewhat technical information, although I've really distilled it down so that it's really understandable. And I think more than 20 minutes without a question and answer break would be too much. So probably every 15, 20 minutes or so, I'll open up the lines, see if there's any questions, address the questions, and then close the line again for participation. So I'm going to go ahead and unmute it right now. Can everyone hear me now? Okay. Now, can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Great. So I'm going to leave it on unmute for just a few minutes while we get started, and then I'll put it on mute when I get into the guts of the information. So everybody has a reason for having signed up for this call, whether it's that you are struggling with some sort of chronic inflammatory condition, you want to prevent some chronic condition, you've got a friend or relative that you'd like to help with the information. So what I'd like each of you to do, if you can, is go ahead and take a piece of paper and a pen or a pencil and just jot down a few words or a few sentences about what your goal is for the call, what you would like to accomplish and have learned by the end of the call. Because what can happen is there's so much stuff that's being presented that you're excited, overwhelmed, whatever the feeling is by the end, that there's so much information you've grasped, but you may hang up and then realize, oh, there was one thing I, you know, completely forgot to ask, and that's the thing, the most important thing for me. So I want you to take a minute right now while your minds are fresh to write that down. What I'd like to also do right at the beginning is take care of a few housekeeping types of things. So the call will be muted so that we get a clean recording. If anybody has an urgent question that can't wait till the end, go ahead. If I've stated something incorrectly or whatever the reason is, you can unmute yourself by *6. But I would prefer that we hold the questions in chunks. That way we don't get interruptions. So when I say, okay, it's time for questions, if you want to ask a question, you can go ahead and hit *6 to unmute yourself. Okay? Is everybody clear? Did everybody get a chance to write down what they came to the call for?
Yes.
Okay. Wonderful. Okay. So what I'd like to do is get started. Okay. What is pain and inflammation? What really are they? And why is it important that we learn about this stuff? Okay, we're all muted again. So, why is it important? Why do we want to come to this call and learn about pain and inflammation? Well, statistics show that inflammation is rampant in our society. How many people do you know that have some sort of a disease condition that they are dealing with that ends in itis, arthritis, osteoarthritis, gastritis, any name, any part of the body, and put an itis at the end, and that's an inflammatory disease. Lots of times we go to the doctors, we get some tests done, we go in complaining about, you know, I have pain over here, I have pain over there, I have pain in my abdomen, and you get a diagnosis of colitis. Well, what does that really mean? What that means is you have inflammation in that area of your body. And inflammation is one of the, it's a cause of pain, one of the causes of pain, the most prevalent cause of pain. So when we go back to the basics, what we perceive in our body is pain. And when we have pain, there's a physiologic process that's going on. And what basically is happening is that there are nerve endings that are part of our system. That's what their job is, to detect chemical or structural or mechanical stress in an area and then feed that back into the brain, and it's perceived as pain. What pain really is our body's warning system. Pain is similar to the beep that happens in a fire alarm when it detects smoke. When your brain perceives some irritation of these little nerve endings, they're like little scavengers or little antennas that go out to various parts of the body and check in. Hey, is everything okay? Is there a problem here? And if there's a problem, it feeds that message back to the brain. Unfortunately, the way that we tend to deal with pain, and that's the kind of Western medicine approach to pain, is to suppress it. So you've got pain, you get a pain-killing medication or an anti-inflammatory medication. And what that does is it disconnects your brain from the source of trouble. So, for example, if you fall and you hurt your ankle and you have pain in your ankle, if you do not suppress the pain, the signal that you're going to be getting from your brain is, be careful of that part. Don't put too much weight on that part. Don't bang that part into something. If we take a pain medication to stop that pain, we feel much better. That's great. But what we do is we run the risk of further injuring ourselves because we're disconnected from the source trouble. We don't believe that there is trouble anymore because we're no longer getting the pain signal. So taking pain medications without really getting at the underlying cause of a problem, of a situation, is a problem, I believe, because a lot of times what happens is that area that's having the trouble gets to get worse and worse and worse. That on top of the fact that there are side effects to taking pain medications, it's not real clear that there's really any benefit except in the situation where the pain is so intense that you just can't function. What I recommend to people when they're in a situation like that and they're taking painkillers is you've got to act as if the pain is still there, especially in the case of acute pain right after an injury. You have to treat that part of your body carefully. Giving another example, if you've got a pain in your abdomen, in your stomach area, you take a pain medication and that pain goes away, and then you go out to the local Mexican restaurant and eat, you know, the tacos and cheese and all kinds of food, that's going to go into that area that's already irritated and make it more irritated. And that's going to cause further malfunction and dysfunction in that area. So before I go on, I just want to make sure that everybody's clear on what that is and ask if there's any questions about that. So I'm going to star 5. Okay. So does anybody have any questions about that definition of pain? Any questions or comments? Is that clear?
Yes.
Is this new to anybody, what that definition?
No.
Okay, so that's pretty basic stuff. Okay, and the line feels really quiet right now, so I'm going to leave it open unless there's some noise in the background. Because for me, it just feels like I'm more connected to the audience when I could just ask a question and hear you guys respond. It's kind of a different scenario being on the phone and not having people's faces to read. So we got the out of the way, what's pain? So what is inflammation? inflammation is basically what we perceive as inflammation. We look at it, something that's inflamed. We see swelling. We see redness. We may feel heat. What's going on? What's happening with that inflammation? Well, the inflammation is actually the body's protective mechanism when you have an injury. So if you bang your elbow and there's some damage to the underlying tissue, your body's going to try to heal that area. So it sends white blood cells into the area. It sends parts of the immune system. It sends more blood into that area to heal it. And when that happens, you get swelling. And especially if it's an area like an elbow where there's not a lot of loose space, there's just lots of bone and skin, if that swells, that's going to cause pain because the swelling is then irritating those pain receptors that we just talked about, and they're giving that signal back to the brain. So you get the perception, hey, something's wrong over here. So why are we trying to get rid of inflammation? We talked about in when I announced this class is we're going to talk about ways that you can manage inflammation. Well, that key word is manage. We don't want to get rid of inflammation. If we were to get rid of inflammation permanently and we were never allowed to get inflammation happening again, we would soon be dead, okay? And that's not an overstatement because inflammation protects us. What doesn't protect us is when the inflammation goes on and on and on and on beyond the point at which the area should be healed. And there's lots and lots of reasons for that. And we're going to discuss lots of those. And just to give you a summary of some of those, nutritional imbalances, biochemical imbalances, not having the right chemistry that will say, oops, inflammation, that's enough, turn it off. It's basically the little firefighters. And we'll show you where and how you can control those by what you eat and also what you think and how you breathe. So there's little receptors, and I mentioned those earlier. What they're called is nociceptors, and they're very sensitive to mechanical stress, but they're even more sensitive to chemical stress. So especially in areas like in the gastrointestinal system, the stomach, the intestinal part, there's a lot of chemicals going in there all the time. We eat foods, and when the foods get broken down, those are chemicals. And depending on what kind of foods we put into our system, we may irritate those little nociceptors that are in the GI tract and cause a feeling of discomfort or pain. Okay? So what happens when we have inflammation, and what I'd like you to do is, did everybody get a chance to print off the flow chart that I sent just about an hour ago?
Yes.
Okay. If anybody hasn't, let me give you the website where you can go to and you can look at that right on your screen while we speak, or you can print it out and take notes on it. Because those flowcharts are going to be important to several of the concepts that we're going to discuss. And what that is www.drritamarie.com, and it's /class notes. With a capital C and a capital N, CLASSNOTES, another /, and it's going to say capital I, inflammation, capital F, flowchart, .pdf. That'll get you directly to the flowchart. And if you want to get the workbook printed out, if you do the same, the drritamarie.com /class notes, capital C, capital N, /pain, P-A-I-N, download, D-O-W-N-L-O-A-D, .htm, that will give you a list of all of the materials for this class. And let me take an aside of something that I should have talked to you about it right at the beginning, is there's a whole bunch of materials that are in there. There's some flow charts, there's some charts. The main ones that we're going to use tonight are the flowcharts and the workbook. The workbook is set up in a, basically it's in an outline form, and there's just bullet points of what we're going to discuss and then a place for you to take your notes. And I wanted to reiterate that if you're taking notes and there's a lot of information and you're not catching it all, don't worry about that, because you'll have a copy of this recording that you can listen to again, but also what you'll have is a transcript of this recording, and that should be available within a week to 10 days. And you'll get it on that same page. So I'll direct you back to that same page anytime I add new information. Okay? And before I continue, I want to make sure that we're all clear on what's on that page, because there's some good information. So the first file that's listed there is called Managing Pain and Inflammation Workbook. That's the workbook that I'm working off of tonight. The second one is the Inflammation Flowchart. The third one is the Anti-Inflammatory Shopping Guide and Recipes, and that will be available tomorrow. And what I did was take all the different foods that are anti-inflammatory that help you to manage inflammation, and I listed them in several pages of charts. And then I put little notes in there as to what about them makes them anti-inflammatory. And then there's some recipes, some really good anti-inflammatory recipes using some of those ingredients. The next one listed is an alkaline diet food chart. And some of you have that chart already if you've worked with me in the past, but it's a good one to have, and that's a chart that I recommend you laminate and keep on your refrigerator. And we're going to talk more about that as we go along. The next two in there are gluten foods list and dairy foods list, and those are basically all the hidden sources of gluten and dairy in our diets. And further along, we're going to talk about the role of gluten and dairy in inflammation. The next one is the alkaline diet description, and that is just a little paper that I downloaded from a site called betterbones.com. It's a very good description of the alkaline diet and why it's important for maintaining health, and we're going to talk about that and its role in inflammation in just a little bit. The last two things on the list are recording and transcript. In the recording, that's where I'm going to load the recording once this call is over, within a few hours or tomorrow morning. I'll get that loaded out there. And the last one will be transcript, and that one probably won't be there for another, you know, week to 10 days. Okay, any questions about the materials?
No.
All right, so are we ready to go on?
Yes.
Okay. So the picture that I want you to look at from the flowchart is called mast cell membrane, and it's got a picture that looks like a little archway. Does everybody see that?
What's it called, please?
Mast, M-A-S-T, cell membrane. Probably at the end. I think it's the last one. This is important. You don't need to remember all the names of all the chemicals and all. That's just for your reference. But what's important is that this membrane, these mast cells, are what's responsible for the production of a chemical called histamine. And histamine is believed to be the major mediator, the major chemical that results in inflammation. And we think about histamine when we think about allergies, right? We take antihistamine medications. If people who have allergies take antihistamines to control their allergies. Well, histamines produce inflammation throughout the body. So inflammation in the gastrointestinal tract, inflammation in the joints, they're mediated by histamines, which are produced by these mast cells. And these chemicals, these leukotrienes, PGE3s, which are prostaglandins, thromboxanes, these are all chemicals that are produced when there's inflammation. And as we go through this, we're going to talk about how you, through your food choices, supplement choices, thoughts, exposures, and your balancing your digestive tract, how you can actually manage and manipulate those to reduce inflammation. Okay. So, what causes inflammation? Okay. So we already talked about that the purpose of inflammation was to heal an area. What causes inflammation to start is usually an insult or a trauma to the body. The body's trying to protect itself. So what's involved with that, generally speaking, is the immune system. And a lot of times we just think about the immune system in terms of protecting us from colds or flus. But the immune system is our protective barrier, and it's responsible for the inflammatory processes and modulating the inflammatory processes. So when we have a stress to the body, there's something called free radicals, and free radicals are formed when there's something called oxidative stress to the body. And so many things can cause that. When we eat fats that have been heated at high temperatures above 118 degrees, they break down and they form things called free radicals. And these free radicals damage tissue, and they cause inflammation in our body. Okay, that's one of the causes. Okay. What also happens during that is we have damage to and depletion of our antioxidants. So, again, in the popular press, when you think of antioxidants, people might be thinking, oh, yeah, vitamin A, vitamin E, vitamin C, those are all antioxidants. And those are antioxidants, but those aren't the most powerful antioxidants. Some of the most powerful antioxidants that help us protect us against injury and illness are antioxidants called superoxide dismutase and glutathione. The reason I'm bringing these up and throwing out these big words is because these are depleted very rapidly by oxidative stress, by free radical damage. There's some genetic defects that have been identified recently in all the genetic research that's being done to see what genetic markers people have. They're finding that there's specific pathways for producing glutathione and replenishing it that are missing or are sluggish in certain people. And you may have that genetic. You have a tendency towards lots of inflammation. You may have that genetic defect, and that doesn't mean that you're doomed to a life of pain and inflammation. What it means is that you have to do more work than someone else who doesn't have that genetic defect to maintain your antioxidant status and thus maintain healthy tissue. Okay. Does that make sense? Does anybody have any questions about that?
So, it's pretty Greek to me, but I'll hear it a couple of times, maybe it'll sink in for me.
Yeah, and you know, here's the thing. I'm giving you a lot of information, and not from the standpoint that I think that you should memorize this, but you're going to, these words will pop out at you if you're ever on the internet and you're ever searching around and reading, you know, a description of a vitamin, which usually it's like, oh, this is this great thing, and it does blah, blah, blah. You'll recognize some of these terms and go, oh, okay, that's for inflammation. I remember that. The other reason I'm giving you this information is because I feel like information is power. When you just have this, somebody, I can get on here and say, here's a list of anti-inflammatory foods, here's a list of inflammatory foods, here's a list of herbs that you can take and supplements that you can take that control inflammation, here's a list of foods, done. You know, and we can be done in a half an hour. But when you walk away from that, you're not going to have a real sense that there's some chemistry behind that. There's some real processes that are having in your body. If I just sort of just made that up, you know, ice cream is anti-inflammatory. Let's all go eat ice cream, yeah. Right? And that may not make intuitive sense to you, but you go, wow, she said it. She's an authority, so maybe that's true. I want to give you information that backs up this stuff, and I believe that when you understand the way your body works more, you're more inclined to stick to a program. If all you have in your head is, well, she said that food's good for me and that food's not good for me, and then 3 weeks later your husband reads an article, your wife or your friend, he says, you know, I just read in the Wall Street Journal that, you know, Campbell's canned soup is actually like one of the best foods for inflammation. And you're going, oh, that doesn't make sense, but wow, it was in the Wall Street Journal. You know, but if you had some understanding of what all those ingredients are in there, and you go, that doesn't make any sense at all, that can't be true. I'm going to stick to what I'm doing right now. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So here's what I want to do.
Marie?
What's that? Yes.
Christy? Yes. it wasn't clear on my phone. You said glutathione, but the word before that, it wasn't. Could you repeat that word?
Oh, sure. It's superoxide dismutase, and you may see it as capital S, capital O, capital G.
Okay.
And
yep.
And the thing is, you can go, and I can give you these words, and they may not make sense to you, and then you can actually go online, and you can type these words into Google, and you can read more, and now you're primed to be able to read more and understand more about what's going on. and then be able to evaluate when somebody says, hey, we have this great new supplement that does this, this, and this, or this food does this or that, you can actually be able to read it with a little bit more, knowledge, background knowledge. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Marie, can you tell me where we're at on the handout?
Yes, we're still on page one.
Oh, okay.
On what causes inflammation. And thank you so much for bringing that up. I'm going to keep you informed as to where I'm at.
Okay.
And I'm going to roughly follow it in order, but there may be a few things that I may pop out of order, because it makes sense in the flow. Okay? So here's another little bit of housekeeping. If you want to ask a question, here's what I would request. If you could please state your name. When I say, hey, are there any questions, state your name, wait for me to acknowledge you, and then go ahead and do your question. That way we don't have people talking over each other, and that way also when the transcript is being created, we'll have a sense of who asked what question, so you'll follow a flow. It won't be just random interjections in there. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. All right, so the next thing on the sheet, it says, what diseases are caused by inflammation? So here's where I want a little bit of interaction. Just call out some diseases that you believe are caused by inflammation. And let's get a list of maybe 5 to 10.
Arthritis.
Arthritis.
Appendicitis.
Appendicitis.
Fibromyalgia.
Great. And that one doesn't follow the rule, does it? That doesn't end in itis, and I'll tell you why in a minute. Okay, any others?
Colitis.
Colitis.
Is lupus an inflammatory illness?
Thank you very much. Lupus is an inflammatory illness, and that is a category of illness called autoimmune. And we're going to discuss those at length further down, probably in the second hour. Thank you. That was a good one. Any others? Okay. I'm going to name a few. Headaches can be inflammatory. Certain kinds of headaches. Gastritis, irritation in the stomach. Esophagitis, irritation in your throat, basically. Bursitis, tendinitis, okay? Now, there's a difference between some of these things that we've mentioned are what's called acute illnesses, which means they are, rapid onset, newly developed. Say an arthritis might be something that's there for a long time. A colitis is kind of a chronic type of thing. But you can have an acute esophagitis. You can have an acute colitis. But most of the times, those are more problems that have been going on long term. Injuries, however, where you might have a tendonitis, sometimes that's just it's an acute problem. You've overworked. You've lifted something too heavy. You have some irritation in your tendon, inflammation. It goes away, and it's under control. But the big problem, and I see this a lot, is that when people have an imbalance in the chemistry that controls inflammation, what happens is they may get an injury that should be self-limiting and should be healed within 7 to 10 days, and it goes on and on and on and on. Has anybody ever had an injury like that?
Yes, I have. This is Pamela.
Yeah. And the problem with that is your body should have been able to say, it's healed now. Turn the inflammation off, but you're probably short in some of the nutrients, and we're going to discuss them in a bit, so your body could turn it off. Okay? So that's a good start. Okay? There's a lot of experts in it. This seminar I went to last weekend that talked a whole lot about the immune system and the nervous system and inflammation was inflammation is arising from an immune system that's out of control. And one of the things we didn't mention over there, allergies are inflammatory. Allergies and autoimmune diseases are actually very, very similar. They are immune systems that just are confused. So in an allergy, there's some very innocuous substance, maybe it's grass, maybe it's oak, something that should not be considered a threat to your body. and your immune system perceives it as a threat and starts to attack it. And so you get histamine release, like we talked about earlier, and you get the runny nose, and you may get a stuffy sinuses, and your droopy eyes, and things like that. On the other side, and that's mediated by a certain part of the immune system. There's T helper cells, and there's two different kinds of T helper cells. And so there's the one that causes those immediate, those allergy-type reactions. And when the other part, the other TH2, is out of control, you get autoimmune diseases. And what an autoimmune disease is body, again, it's confused. It's attacking your own body. It's attacking parts of your own body. And why does it do this? Well, we're going to talk about that in just a little bit. Okay, there's a whole bunch of reasons that you can actually control. There are a lot of them. Okay. So, measuring inflammation. There's lots of ways to measure inflammation. Okay, if there's certain blood tests that can be done, and there's something called C-reactive protein. It's a standard blood panel kind of a thing that doctors will run if they suspect an inflammatory or an autoimmune disease. Another thing is fats in your body. The balance between the fats controls whether you're in an inflammatory state. A pro-inflammatory means it promotes inflammation, or an anti-inflammatory state. And we all want to be striving for being in an anti-inflammatory state. So we could test fats. There's a test called the intestinal barrier function, which tests to see how well is our intestine keeping us protected from the bad stuff, and how well is it letting through the good stuff. Okay, we'll talk about the intestines in just a little bit. Oxidative stress markers. We talked a little while ago about glutathione and superoxide dismutase. We can actually measure the degree of oxidative stress in our bodies. Another way of indirectly measuring inflammation is testing our pH in both our saliva and urine. Our bodies want to be alkaline in pH. Our blood tends towards a pH of about 7.3. pH is a measure of hydrogen in the body, and basically 7 is neutral. Acid is below 7, alkaline is above 7. So our bodies function best in a slightly alkaline environment. When our pH is just a little bit above 7, like 7.35 seems to be the ideal. Well, when we eat certain foods, think certain thoughts, take medications, our body, even exercise, throws our body into a more acid state. There's acid byproducts of just day-to-day life, stressful thinking, eating foods, digestion. There's all kinds of things that produce acid in our body. And when we get too much acid in our body has to maintain that pH in the blood. So what it does is it tries to find alkalinity. So if you've eaten and you've exercised and you've been exposed to chemicals and all of a sudden your tissues are very alkaline, well, we've got to maintain, very acid, we've got to keep that blood alkaline. So the blood draws from stores of minerals in your body. And the biggest store of alkaline minerals in your body is the bone. And so one of the side effects of being too acid is that you can get osteoporosis. Okay? Another place it could draw from is the saliva. The mouth tends to be alkaline, and it needs to be alkaline for the salivary amylase, which is an enzyme that helps us to digest starch. And so it pulls it out of there. The tissues tend to do better, like your liver, like your GI tract. The mucous membranes, they do better when they are alkaline. But when the blood is at risk of becoming acid, it draws those alkaline buffers from those tissues and puts it into the blood to maintain the blood, because that's what's threatening, okay? And when the other tissues get out of balance, it's not life-threatening immediately, but what it is very uncomfortable. So you get buildup of these acid wastes in the tissues. The acid wastes, remember we talked about pain receptors and how they are very sensitive to chemicals, they can create pain. And so the immune system perceives an assault, it gets in there, and inflammation results. So it's very important for maintaining a proper pH in your system and eating foods that are very alkaline forming. The other thing that's very, very important is your mineral status. So if you're eating foods that are just chock full of minerals, you're drinking lots of green drinks and you're eating lots of sea vegetables and there's lots of minerals coming into your body, and then you go eat a pizza, your body's more able, which is very acid forming, your body's more able to neutralize the acids because you've got so many good minerals coming in. But if you're eating the standard American diet, which is very low in minerals, most people are deficient in at least 3 to 5 of their minerals, if not more, then what happens is there's no mineral buffers, and we have to go steal it from the tissues, and we get out of balance. And I see that a lot. Okay, so I'm going to stop here and field any questions before we go on. And I want to get some feedback. Is this too much depth, not enough depth, just about right?
I have a question. This is Beverly.
Sure. Yeah, Beverly.
Are what you're telling us, is this going to be put into the notebook, or are we supposed to be taking detailed notes?
You will be getting a transcript of everything that
I said.
Okay,
but it's not going to be put into the notebook.
It won't be, I won't word for word. You'll be getting a transcript, which is a written version of word for word what I said.
Okay.
So that will happen in about 2 weeks. We'll have it transcribed, or 10 days. Okay. The charts are in the notes. The alkaline information will be in the notes. Okay? So you're not going to miss anything. So you could take notes, but anything you miss, you can either go back and listen again, or you can read it in the transcript word by word. And that's usually really helpful for filling in the blanks. Okay?
Okay.
All right. So is this too much detail? Is this more than you want to know?
No, this is good. This is good.
Okay. Anybody think it's more than they want to know at this point?
Okay. No,
this is all going to come together. I want to give you the background so when I make recommendations as far as what foods, what herbs, things like that, you're gonna feel like, oh, okay, that makes sense. That makes sense. Even if it doesn't feel like, you don't have to remember the names of the leukotrienes and all that kind of stuff, but you've got that in your memory bank. Okay. So, all right. Autoimmune diseases. Let me talk a little bit about autoimmune diseases, and I have a picture that I want to pull up. Okay. In your intestine, when food comes in, we think about our gut as just this tube that, you know, stuff goes in one end and out the other, and some of it gets absorbed into the bloodstream. But there's a lot of intelligence in that. And your intestinal tract is that main line of defense. And it's got to make some decisions. So think about this. You've got your body, and it has certain genetic markers. It has certain protein structures, and it looks a certain way. And if something comes in to that, so something goes down your throat, your body has to decide, okay, is this friend or is this foe? Okay? That's a big decision. First it goes, is it self or is it not self? So obviously when the food comes in, it's not self. So then it's the next level of discussion is, okay, do we need to attack it or do we need to embrace it? Okay? And so it looks at the protein structure and you've got certain, you know, patterns that it's detecting, and it goes, oh, okay, that's kale protein. That's good. That's friend. Okay? Let's just, you know, break it on down and let it on through. Oh, that's streptococcus. That gets into my bloodstream. That's going to wreak havoc. Whoops. Got to attack that. Okay? And so it starts this whole cascade of T cells and lymphocytes and all and starts to attack it. Okay? Mercury comes in, or some of the chemicals and pesticides that are in our food. Are they friend or are they foe? Well, what we used to believe, or immunology used to believe, was that the chemicals were too small a molecular size to actually trigger the immune response, the same kind of an immune response as would a bacteria. But what they're finding is that because they're coming in as part of an organic matter, and they're attaching themselves onto the cells, the molecules of the food that you're eating, they get perceived as enemy, and the body attacks that. So when your body's attacking say, you know, PCBs or some sort of chemical that comes in and trying to protect you from that, it's attached to a food protein. And so it can create an allergic reaction to, in addition to attacking the chemical and neutralizing the chemical, it can be attacking the food molecule. Okay, so that's one way that we can end up with food allergies. It's not the only way, and that's not the most common way, but that is one way. So that's why it is important to eat as much as you can, eat organically grown foods, so that you don't have all these foreign chemicals coming into your body to wreak havoc on the immune system. Okay, so then it's got to decide, is this friend or is this foe? And what happens if it decides that it's foe, it creates this immune response. And so these chemicals that are created as part of the immune response are irritating because they're supposed to kill and neutralize the enemy, okay? And if you've got tissue in the way, it's going to get a little irritated. So one of the scientists that I heard speak about, he talked about the fact that there's this constant chronic low-grade inflammation in your gut happening all the time. But if you're eating and drinking a lot of things that are considered foe, and there's a lot of this going on, then the lining of the digestive tract gets compromised. And so it's supposed to be this nice, beautiful membrane. And as I said earlier in the call, I have a beautiful picture that I want to get to. I'm just trying to figure out how to get it from the tiny little PowerPoint picture that I have into a full-blown picture that I can send to you. And when I do, you'll get it. Because it just really illustrates this constant almost battle. It is. It's almost like a war zone that's going on in your intestinal tract. It's those soldiers in the front line of defense trying to keep the bad stuff from entering into your bloodstream. But as a result, you know, there's the bloodying, the damage that happens. If you think about, you know, if it was a real war, the grass would get mucked up, the flowers would be, you know, a lot of things would get messed up because of the ammunition that's being fired, and it happens in your gut. So when that happens, the membranes in the gut lining are being compromised, and you get pieces of these larger molecules that are normally prevented from being able to go in are going in. Okay? Do you get a visual picture of what's happening? Anybody?
Yes.
Yes? A war zone in your gut?
Yes.
Okay? Mm-hmm. So we want to keep the war. We want to keep the enemies down to a minimum. Right? And we'll talk in a couple of minutes about what some of those methods are. So autoimmune happens when, basically, when our tissue gets in the way of the bad guys, right? And so, or when an antibody, an immune system attacking molecule is similar to the structure of a body part. So our immune system works on this lock and key kind of a basis where you've got a bad guy. Say you've got a bacteria and it's got a certain structure. An antibody that's specific for that has a protein structure that's complementary to it so that they fit together so that that antibody can embrace that bad guy and just mark him so that the rest of the immune system can attack it. What happens is there's just so many different variations and combinations of the 20 amino acids that we get so that when there's a similarity between one of these bad guys and, say, the lining of our gut or our thyroid or our stomach or the cells in the pancreas that produce insulin, then our body has these antibodies that start to attack our own system, and that's the beginning of autoimmune disease. It is now believed that all autoimmune disease begins in the gut. Okay? So having a healthy gut, eating really good foods that support the gut is really critical for the prevention and also for the treatment of autoimmune disease. Okay? Does everybody understand what an autoimmune disease is? Okay. We've got, somebody mentioned lupus earlier. We've got Hashimoto's, thyroiditis, diabetes type 1. Diabetes is considered to be an autoimmune disease. Type 2 is actually starting to be considered an autoimmune disease in that we're attacking our insulin receptors on our cell. That's still, you know, not
as widely believed as the type 1. There's lots of autoimmune diseases, scleroderma, Sjogren's, and they're all pretty devastating. They're basically all the same disease. They all have different names, but they're basically all the same disease. It's just which tissues are getting attacked. Does that make sense? So I'm on page 2, and I'm at the bottom, and it's just the role of drugs in managing inflammation. Okay? So there's several kinds of drugs that medical doctors prescribe, or over-the-counter type drugs that people take for managing inflammation. Aspirin and Tylenol are two of the most common, as well as some of the other what's called non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. So they're anti-inflammatory, but they're not steroids. Steroids are considered the cannons, and the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories are considered the handguns, if you want to look at it in terms of this war that we've kind of envisioned. So some of the other NSAIDs are Advil, Motrin, Aleve. Okay? That's considered the old class of non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. The newer class of non-steroidal anti-inflammatories are called COX-2 inhibitors. Is that a new term to anyone?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
This is Pamela.
Okay, cool. Those that you're going to keep hearing more and more about those, there's synthetic COX-2 inhibitors, but there's also natural COX-2 inhibitors. And there are several herbs that we're going to be talking about in a little while that actually have these COX-2 inhibitors. COX-2 stands for cyclooxygenase 2. Okay, it's an enzyme in the body, and when it's an enzyme that causes inflammation. And when we inhibit that enzyme, we get a reduction in inflammation. So this new category of drugs, Celebrex and Vioxx, has anybody ever heard of those? Those have probably been on the news. Those are a newer class of anti-inflammatories that are COX-2 inhibitors. They work much better. They have much less side effects than the other non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. However, the jury's out as to what damage these are doing, because they're relatively new. So, like anything, drugs come out, and everybody goes, wow, this is great, and then 5, 10, 15 years later, we're finding all sorts of side effects. So, wouldn't it be nice if we could get an effect that's similar to these COX-2 inhibitors from food? And let's talk about really briefly the difference between, what's the difference if I get that chemical and, somebody just synthesized it in a lab, or I get it in food? Why would that be different? Well, I'll tell you, there's a lot of reasons why it's different. One is, in nature, that chemical, that active ingredient, is packaged with all kinds of other chemicals, antioxidants, bioflavonoids, protective-type chemicals, demulcents, which are actually things like that soothe. You think of aloe vera, how nice that feels on a burned skin. There's other demulcents, that's called a demulcent type of chemicals that are in these plants, so that when you take one of these plants that has these COX-2 inhibitors in it, it's got this big package of other stuff that prevents the side effects that just taking the active ingredient out doesn't do. And that's where I think that, a lot of drugs are based on chemicals that occur in nature. The problem is, we as man, as scientists, think that, that's the active ingredient, let's isolate it out, whereas I think that the real intelligence is in nature, because there's so many chemicals we don't even know about that are in there, and there's so many problems that we get into when we isolate those chemicals out. So what we want to talk about tonight is, I wanted to introduce you to some of the drugs and how they work, but what I wanted to do is let you know that there are alternatives to that. Now, there are some times when the pain is just so intense, the person is suffering so much, that it's really important to break that pain cycle. And then you want to choose the least invasive drug therapy to just get them over the hump while they're incorporating some of these other natural therapies to help the pain. Does that make sense? So the other class of drugs that are used, as we said before, are steroids. And if anybody has ever been on steroids, you know that they are fraught with side effects. They cause weight gain, they cause truncal obesity, they cause muscle breakdown, weakness, they impair the immune system. There's lots of reasons why you don't want to go on steroids. But on the other hand, there are some herbs that actually have a steroidal type effect in terms of decreasing the inflammation without all the bad side effects. And one of the ones I can think of off the top of my head is licorice root. Okay? And that's being used a lot more in putting in people's inhalers instead of some of the steroids, like people with asthma, to help with lung inflammation, and being used with great success. So there are lots of alternatives to that. Steroids are usually reserved for cases when the pain is chronic and the pain is unable to be controlled by the non-steroidal. So what I want you to do right now is go to your pack I'm just going to find mine. Your pack of flowcharts, okay? And I think it's the very first one. It might be the second one. It says inflammatory cascade at the top. Does everybody have that one?
Second one.
The second one.
Okay. And I think they got slightly out of order. The one before that was probably the drug modulation. So, inflammatory cascade. I think it's time to talk a little bit about how we can control the inflammation. And the best way to do that is to see what's really going on in the inflammation. Again, this chart is as simple as I could get it. There's a lot more that goes on in this. There's a lot of other chemicals. But this is as simple as I could break it down to. Please do not think that you have to remember any of the names of these enzymes, the names of these chemicals. But basically, I'd like to give you a graphical view. And what I want you to see is that down the middle is the inflammatory cascade. So it says membrane phospholipids. Phospholipids are a kind of fat. That membrane referring to in your cells. Those fats, some of the dietary fats that you eat, get broken down, and one of the chemicals that get produced is arachidonic acid. That's that middle box, arachidonic acid. Very, very inflammatory. Okay? Arachidonic acid is the precursor to those big, bad chemicals that, I'm saying bad, but they're not really bad. They're really our friends. They're just bad when they get out of control. But in that original picture we looked at, those leukotrienes and the thromboxanes. Arachidonic acid. Now, where do we get arachidonic acid? Anybody know where that comes from in our food supply? No? Okay. It is in meat, any kind of flesh food, with the exception of fish. It's in eggs, it's in dairy products, and it's in peanuts. Okay? So we're not saying arachidonic acid is bad and we have to kill all the arachidonic acid, but our body can make arachidonic acid whenever it needs it. Okay? So let's go up to the top of the page where it says linoleic acid and linolenic acid. And I want you to take a pen and write on the side that says linoleic acid, on the left side of the paper, write omega-6. And on the other side, where it says alpha-linolenic acid, I want you to write omega-3. So the reason I give you this picture is because I don't know who hasn't heard of omega-3s and omega-6s. It's in the news all the time. It's not just in nutritional information anymore. It's all over the place. Oh, yeah, did you get your omega-3s today? Has anybody not heard of omega-3s and omega-6s? This is why the balance of those fats is so important, is because they play a really primary role in managing inflammation. So if we look down, linoleic acid gets converted into GLA, DGLA, and then down into this thing called PG1, and it's right there by the little fireman. You see the fireman? Okay. He's putting out the fire. If you look down at this thing called leukotrienes and thromboxanes, you see the little flames coming up off of those? That's the fire. That's inflammation. So if we have a good balance of omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids, we've got lots of these little firemen coming there with their hoses and putting out the inflammation. And that's good, right? That's what we want. Okay, the inflammation goes. We bring all the chemicals the body needs to heal the area. We're done. Put out the fire. What tends to happen with our standard American diet, which is high in processed foods and animal products and processed vegetable fats. We get a lot of arachidonic acid, and we don't get enough primarily of the alpha-linoleic acid and the EPA on the omega-3 side. Okay. And I want you to pay careful attention to this part, because this is important. Omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids need to be in balance, and ideally, one-to-one balance. And if they're in a one-to-one balance, they work together to put out inflammation. It can go up to as much as a three-to-one balance, and they'll still do a pretty good job. What happens if we get more than three times the amount of the omega-6s than we have of the omega-3s? Is that part of the extra of the omega-6s get converted into arachidonic acid? And I want you to follow down on that line where it says linoleic acid, GLA, DGLA, and then there's a line that goes over to arachidonic acid. Okay, so if we have more than enough of the linoleic acid in relation to the omega-3 side, a big bunch of that is going to be no longer anti-inflammatory. It's going to go and support the inflammation. Okay? On the other hand, if we look on the omega-3 side, the alpha-linolenic acid gets converted to EPA, and the EPA actually displaces. You see where there's the same arrow going across to arachidonic acid, but it says displaces. Okay, so EPA displaces arachidonic acid. Okay, it means that it pushes it aside. So not only does the EPA help by producing firemen to put out the fire, but it helps by pushing the arachidonic out of the way so it can't do its job of creating inflammation. Okay. Does this make sense at all?
Mm-hmm.
Does this give you kind of a visual so when people talk about omega-3s and omega-6s, you get a good feel?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, so let's turn to, I think it was the page right before that, they got a little bit out of order, called drug modulation.
Yeah.
You see that?
Yeah.
Okay. What I want you to do is look down towards the bottom of the page. You see where we've got the fire again. That's the thromboxanes on one side and the leukotrienes and the HTEs and all that. When we take non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications, Aleve, naproxen, Tylenol, aspirin, what it does is it gets in that field. You see where there's a box that says NSAIDs down between arachidonic acid and thromboxane?
Yeah.
Okay. Those non-steroidal anti-inflammatories go in there, and it prevents the conversion of the arachidonic acid into the fire, basically. It stops the fire. See, there's no more fire there. Right? It doesn't do anything for the other side of the pathway. Right? So if we've got a mild inflammation and all we've got is these thromboxanes and we take some non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, we feel better. But I want you to see that it's a short-lived feel better. Okay? So if you look up at the chart, you see this N sets up there again between alpha-linolenic acid and N-linoleic acid? It also prevents our body from taking the dietary fats and converting them to EPA and creating firefighters and TG1, so we don't get the firefighters anymore. See how the firefighters have X's through them? So on the one hand, taking these non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications is great. Gets rid of the fire. But on the other hand, it also gets rid of the firefighters. So you become completely dependent on that drug to manage the inflammation. And as soon as you stop taking it, the inflammation comes back, because you killed off your firefighters. Okay, so it's not really a good long-term solution, even though there's lots of people taking these medications on a long-term basis. Does that make sense? Okay. So the other thing I want to mention, we talked about steroids. Steroids are the big cannons, okay? So the big cannons affect everything. The big cannons turn off the good guys. They kill the firefighters. But they also kill all the fires. They don't leave that one little fire going. So if you've got a big old fire burning, you've got an autoimmune disease, you've got, you know, thickened inflammation in your lungs and you can't breathe, they give you the steroids. And that just knocks it all out. Okay? But again, it's a short-lived solution.
Okay. So what do we do about it? I know I'm painting kind of a picture here of like, ah, this is not good. But the good news is we can control it. Okay? How do we control it? Let's look at the next chart, which says nutritional. There's two of them we're going to look at the same time. One says nutritional modulation, and the other one, that's a picture. Yeah, both of them say nutritional modulation, but they're two somewhat different pictures. Does everybody have that? One's on landscape mode and one's on a portrait mode. Does everybody have those in front of them? Okay. So the good news is we can help this. We can actually get in and help this. Okay? And there's lots of ways that we can do it. One of the ways is that we can balance our omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids in our diet, and we can decrease the arachidonic acid. Okay? What do we do? How do we do that? Well, we limit or eliminate meat, dairy, eggs, and peanuts from our diet. And that gets rid of our dietary sources of arachidonic acid. So that's good, okay? Because our body knows, we know our body can make it if we have enough of the omega-6s. The DGLA will convert to it whenever it needs to. We don't need to have extra hanging around to cause inflammation when we don't need inflammation. It just basically feeds. If we have any fires going, you need arachidonic acid. It's just putting more flame into that fire, okay? So if you take away the dietary sources, you decrease a lot of that inflammation. Secondly, we can make sure that we have a balance between our omega-3 and our omega-6 fatty acids. And if we look at the page that's on its side, it talks about some of the sources of the omega-3s, but I'm going to add a few more for you. It says alpha-linoleic acid, it says flax, pumpkin. I want you to write in chia and hemp. These are all foods, seeds, that we can include in our diet on a regular basis, a daily basis, to help support our body in making firefighters. Okay? So think about every time you have flax and pumpkin and chia and hemp, you're feeding your firefighters. It's good news. Those firefighters do good work, and they deserve to be fed. Okay? But the thing is about this, if we don't have enough of our B vitamins and our minerals and our vitamin C, those are listed on the side of the arrow going down. What those mean are, that's a cofactor. It means that without those, the B3, the B6, the vitamin C, the zinc, and the magnesium, we cannot convert our alpha-linoleic acid from the flax, hemp, chia, or pumpkin. We cannot convert those to the EPA and then down to the prostaglandin. We just can't do it. Okay, so we have to make sure that we're eating foods that contain these. What foods contain all that? Fresh fruits and vegetables. Whole grains versus refined grains are good sources of some of these. But the typical American diet, which is white bread, bagels, pizza for lunch, I mean, think about it. Is it inflammatory or is it non-inflammatory? Right? Eggs and bacon for breakfast with some toast. Inflammatory. Okay? Pizza or a hamburger for lunch. Inflammatory. You know, go home for dinner and have some steak and mashed potatoes and some green beans. Except for the green beans, it's inflammatory because the mashed potatoes probably have, you know, milk in them. Okay? So we're eating. People are eating on a regular basis all these foods that are very inflammatory. Fruits, vegetables, whole grains, nuts, and seeds, and legumes are anti-inflammatory, with very few exceptions. I threw out the peanuts as an inflammatory food. Okay. When we process those whole foods, they become inflammatory. Why? Because they're robbed of their nutrition. Okay? So when you say, ah, what the heck, you know, my joint pains aren't going to be affected by going out and having, you know, some pizza or, you know, that bagel or whatever, It's not true. It is being affected. Every time you make a choice that's inconsistent with anti-inflammatory, if you've got an ongoing condition, it's going to make it worse. And even if you don't feel it making it worse, it's making it worse on the inside. One of the diseases I forgot to mention as an inflammatory disease is heart disease.
artery disease. We think about cholesterol as being the culprit in heart disease. Like, oh, we got to get the cholesterol down. But what we're finding, the latest research is showing, and not everybody's up to speed on it, is that cholesterol is, again, it's a symptom. It's a symptom of out-of-control inflammation. Cholesterol is a very potent anti-inflammatory that our body creates to try to manage inflammation. The unfortunate thing is that the inflammation in our blood vessels causes damage to the lining, and then the cholesterol kind of goes there to try to heal the damage, and then we get minerals that block up in there, and then we get clots. We get big old blocks, okay? And the inflammation causes the blood vessels to constrict, and we get narrowing of the blood vessels. So cholesterol really isn't the culprit. What the culprit is inflammation. And when we keep this inflammation under control, so every time you eat something that's inflammatory, it's not just your joints, it's not just your lupus, it's the insides of your blood vessels that are also getting damaged, and it's unseen. And if it's an autoimmune disease, it's just furthering the destructive damage to that tissue, to that thyroid gland, to the lining of your gut, to the cells in your pancreas that make insulin. Okay, so it's really important to really make sense of this anti-inflammatory diet and stick to it as much as you possibly can. Okay, does that make sense? Does everybody get that? Do you see where it says in the middle of this page, delta 6 desaturates? That's the enzyme that takes our food fatty acids, our food omega-3s and 6s, and converts them downstream to the firefighters, basically. Okay? Things that decrease the activity of that enzyme are trans fats. Does everybody know what trans fats are? Great. Alcohol, coffee, food additives, and we could add chemicals, mercury, pesticides. All of those things, they just basically interfere with that enzyme's ability to do its job and make firefighters. So if you eat those things, every time you eat those things, you're killing off a firefighter somewhere, okay? And that might be a graphic that you could use in your mind. Okay, so that's the food piece, and that's not the whole of the food piece, but that's just a big part of the food piece. From a nutritional standpoint, in terms of supplementation, if we are not eating a diet that's rich in this, then we need to be taking supplements of this. You know, if somebody's on a standard American diet, they're eating lots of processed foods, then they need to be taking supplements of these nutrients. Otherwise, there's no way that they're going to do it. Or taking fish oils, which is EPA, actually works in and of itself. But the EPA still has to be converted to the PGE3s, and we do need some of those enzymes to be able to do that. Okay, so if we look at the other chart that says nutritional modulation, it says linoleic acid, alpha-linoleic acid. If you look down between membrane phospholipids and arachidonic acid, there's a little box that says vitamin E and curcumin. Curcumin is the active ingredient in turmeric, which is a yellow herb spice that's used very heavily in Indian food. It's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful herb. I can't say enough about turmeric. It has been found to be helpful in liver conditions, in cancers, in all sorts of inflammatory diseases, in autoimmune diseases. It's a wonderful spice, and I highly recommend that you just get some turmeric and find ways to use it. There's lots of Indian food recipes that you can do, and I'm going to include a recipe for an Indian curried vegetable dish that includes ginger, which is another one, and turmeric that I think you'll like. And I also have in that recipe book, I have a recipe for a green soup that has all the minerals from the greens, plus it's got ginger and turmeric and coconut oil, which is anti-inflammatory, and it's got some of the hemp and, chia, I can't remember which one it has in there, but some of the omega-3 fats in there. So got some recipes in there that really focus on anti-inflammatory. Okay, so when you get that vitamin E and the curcumin, the turmeric, it actually does similar effects to steroids. And another herb that you could add to that isn't quite as potent is licorice root. Okay, so you see our firefighters are real happy when we intervene with inflammation from a nutritional standpoint. They still get to work. In fact, they work better than they were before. And when we do bioflavonoids and ginger and vitamin E and fish oils and zinc and selenium and all these different nutrients, they actually help decreasing the conversion of the arachidonic acid to those chemicals. Does that make sense? So you're doing your body good on both fronts, as opposed to just, you know, killing off everything, killing off the firefighters and the fire at the same time. You're much better off killing off the fire and keeping the firefighters. Okay. So I'm going to stop here and see if there's any questions.
Now, this is Chris. I just wanted to insert here. I went to Bali last year, and I went to a healer, and they serve turmeric root raw, grated in a glass of water with lemon, lime, and a little honey. And they highly advocate doing turmeric to clean the blood. That's like their answer for everything.
It's a wonderful herb, and that's a great way to do it. Getting turmeric raw like that is hard, but sometimes Central Market or Whole Foods here in Austin carry that.
Yes.
And whenever I find it, I buy it, and I grate it up, and I put it into things. But that's a great way to do it. You could start your day with this wonderful antioxidant beverage. Get a glass of water, put some lemon in it, grate some turmeric in it, put some ginger in there. You know, if you need a little honey or agave to sweeten it up, then drink it down. It's a wonderful way to start your day, and it's a great beverage to have later in the day.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Turmeric can be added to guacamole. It can be added to any kind of nut or seed cheese, and I've got a recipe for that in the recipes that I'm going to be sending you. Turmeric can be added to lots of things, as can ginger. I add ginger to just about all my green soups and smoothies, and I make that by blending up, you know, fresh fruits and greens, and I add turmeric to some of them, quite a few of them.
So
thank you
for sharing
that.
So when you don't have the raw one, you just use the dried?
Yes, I just use the dried.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not as potent
right.
like anything else. You know, when you dry it, it loses some of its activity, but it's still pretty potent.
Okay.
And the other thing you could do is if you want to do it in a supplement form, if you really just can't tolerate the taste, you can get capsules of turmeric.
Yeah.
So it's a wonderful, wonderful food herb medicine. There's nothing but good things to say about it. Any other questions?
Rita Marie?
Yeah.
This is Pamela. And I just have a...
Hi, Pamela.
You could just summarize this arachidonic acid.
Mm-hmm.
Would you consider that to be the firefighter?
No, arachidonic acid is the bad guy.
Oh, okay.
It's the precursor to the bad guy. Okay, arachidonic acid is the chemical, it's a fat, it's not a chemical, it's a fat that's found in meats, cheeses, dairy products, and peanuts.
Okay.
And it, what it does is it gets converted into the basically those chemicals, the fire. They get converted to the fire.
Okay, I get it.
Okay? Your flax and chia and pumpkin and all, they support the firefighters in their job. They make more firefighters.
Okay.
Does that make sense? So whenever you're going to reach for, you know, some peanuts or, you know, some heavy cheese or whatever, just think about the poor old firefighters that are just having more fire to have to fight. Okay? And when you're eating your flax and chia and taking foods like vegetables and sea vegetables with all those minerals and vitamins, think about how you're giving your body this renewed staff of firefighters. Okay? Any other questions before we move on?
Marina Marie, this is Beverly Haldeman. I've heard about a lot of these things before, and I am appalled that we see all these advertisements for 5 dairy a day, making you lose weight, and, you know, all these... I know this is probably outside of this class, but what can we do to do something about that?
Well, the only thing I can think of is just wherever you're seeing this is write to people, you know. I don't really, it's a great question, and I don't have an answer to that, and you're right, we could spend hours kind of brainstorming. And maybe we should have a call. Maybe we should have a call and get everybody together, and let's brainstorm about what could we do to get this misinformation that's being fed to people and get it out of the way. What appalls me even more than that is some of the books that are out there, and I'll give you a list of some of the books that are out there, but I haven't found one book, maybe I found one, that has really good information and then the conclusions that it draws from the information about the foods to eat make sense with the information. So let me give you an example. There's the one the anti-inflammatory zone, Barry Sears, and the zone diet, Barry Sears. And he talks all at length about fats and all this stuff, the same stuff we're talking about here, and how arachidonic acid and eicosanoids and good eicosanoids and bad eicosanoids, and we want to make sure we get the good eicosanoids. Well, what he does is has recipes that have bacon and cheese in them. And that, to me, is appalling. Those are inflammatory foods. But I think it's a lot of the books and a lot of the literature is trying to appeal to the masses, the taste of the masses. Well, we don't want to give up that. You know, we want to have our cake and eat it too. You know, and it doesn't work that way. There's a price to pay. And if you want to be healthy and you want to have your inflammation under control and you want to get autoimmune disease at bay, there's a price to pay. And the price to pay is you need to start feeding yourself anti-inflammatory foods and get rid of the inflammatories. So there's lots of good information out there, but you have to draw your own conclusions. You know, you go, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. He just said that that causes that, but then he has that in a recipe. It doesn't make sense to me.
And it's the same thing with gluten, too.
Okay, thank you for bringing up gluten. We're just about to talk about diet. We've talked about the fats. We've talked about the minerals and vitamins. Gluten. Gluten and dairy, and that's another reason for the dairy. You know, it appalls me with the dairy. Not just does dairy contain the arachidonic acid, which promotes inflammatory cascade, it has a protein called casein. And casein and gluten have been implicated over and over again in the medical literature, and this is just not in alternative literature. These are studies that are published in mainstream medical journals that talk about the role of gluten and casein in inflammation, autoimmune disease, depression, autism, you name it, thyroid disease. All right? Why? Why are these things bad? What happens? Well, these proteins, when they get broken down, there's a couple of reasons. One, these proteins, when they get broken down, the intermediary peptides, which are short chains of proteins, they're not quite the little tiny amino acids that get absorbed into the bloodstream. They're peptides. And they are opiates. They trigger opiate reactions. Okay? And when they get into the bloodstream in the brain, they put us on a high. They basically, it's like we just took some morphine or cocaine. One of the reasons why they're so addictive. Anybody ever notice if you eat a piece of bread, you're gone, or you might as well eat the whole loaf or have somebody hide it or whatever. You just crave to eat more. Same thing with cheese. You know, it's hard to just eat one piece of cheese or ice cream. You know, and ice cream has sugar in it as well. But so there's a lot of stuff that goes on. But the proteins in these foods tend to create autoantibodies. They're similar in structure to antibodies in other parts of the body. There's a whole, I mean, I could spend 4 or 5 hours talking about gluten. I've written an extensive 30-page paper about it. I've got, resources up to the gazoo about the casein interaction. But basically, gluten and casein trigger autoimmune processes. They basically create antibodies that, they cause the creation of antibodies that attack body tissue. Okay. So anybody that has an autoimmune disease, the first thing they say is, you've got to get off dairy and you've got to get off meat. It may be a lifelong avoidance. It may not be, but at least during the healing phase. Because here's the deal. If you have an autoimmune reaction that's damaging your gut lining or that's damaging your collagen tissue or that's damaging your thyroid gland, and it's happening because of a cross-reaction with a gluten or a casein protein, and you stop the gluten and casein, you allow the inflammation to get under control. If then you just say, oh, one little bite's not going to hurt me, you have that little bite, even if you don't get some overt symptoms like you get diarrhea or throw up or, you know, have joint pain, that inflammation, that inflammatory cascade gets started again. So you don't give the tissues a chance to heal. Very, very, very important. I really highly recommend anybody that has any kind of pain, just try it for 3 weeks to a month and see how it goes. And you might see remarkable results. But don't do it in such a way that you try it and then you just go, oh, I'll just have a little bit. Give yourself that gift of just doing it 100% for at least a month. Excuse me, one second. I've got it. Talking about inflammation, my child decided to contribute to the call, and he came in with an inflamed foot because he just banged himself. Sorry about that interruption. Real life example. Okay, so gluten and casein, and anything that you're allergic to. Why do we get allergic to these things? Why? So that's the key question. Most of it goes back to when we were little teeny tiny babies. If we were breastfed, we have less of a chance of developing these conditions. If we were formula fed, we have more of a chance of developing these conditions. If we're breastfed, we get mother's milk, we get all those protective antibodies that protect the lining of our gut. Our guts, when we're born, are porous to allow those antibodies to enter. When you have cow's milk or soy milk or whatever else that we're feeding babies these days, and you have this gut that is allowing molecules to pass through because the only molecules it's expecting are antibodies from its mom to help protect its immune system, those things get into the system, and we start real early on with those antibodies. The other issue gets in if we are breastfed and our moms are not eating a good diet, and our moms have lots of food allergies, and they are eating the foods that they're allergic to, then some of the antibodies that you're going to get are going to be passed on from the mom. So either way, you know, you're much better off if you are breastfed, but you can still be getting exposure if you're breastfed from a woman who is eating foods that she's allergic to. The other thing that's real important, and this happens early on in our lives, is having good flora in our gut, good bacteria that are supposed to protect us. There's lots and lots of things that they do. They create enzymes. They help us to digest. This gut flora is real important, and it's established early on, and it's established from the components, the chemical constituents in breast milk, in the species-specific milk. And a lot of us, I don't know about you, but I think I was breastfed for maybe a week or two, and then my mom gave it up and I was put on formula. And so I didn't really get a chance to develop that good flora that I should have developed. This gives us another little challenge to our immune system. So remember we talked about how it has to go friend or foe? Well, bacteria versus food versus chemicals. We complicate it a little bit, and it's like some of the bacteria are actually friendly. Some of the bacteria are not. And it's always having to choose, and sometimes it makes a mistake. And it can make a mistake because it's confused, because there's been damage, the immune system is not fully intact. Okay, so diet. Let's talk about some diet stuff. We already talked about fats. Well, before I skip ahead to that, before we get to that, and I'm just going to briefly touch on these because that's not the focus of this class. We can do a whole other class on that. But our attitudes, our stress levels, our exercise, environmental exposures all play a role in inflammation as well. Recent discoveries have shown that the lymphocytes, cells in the immune system, actually have receptors for neurotransmitters. And neurotransmitters are those chemicals that our brain produces, our body produces to communicate. So depression is one of the neurotransmitter deficiency diseases, neurotransmitter imbalance diseases. But our neurotransmitters, some of them are excitatory neurotransmitters, and some of them are calming neurotransmitters. Some of them make us feel really peaceful. Some of them make us feel angry. When we've got anger, when we've got negative emotion, we've got neurotransmitters that are not pleasant for our system. And so when our immune system picks up on those, it changes the ratios of the T helper cells and the T suppressor cells, and those are really critical in maintaining proper immune balance. When those ratios get off, it can contribute to inflammation. Stress. There's a hormone called cortisol that gets released when we are stressed, and there's a neurotransmitter called adrenaline. But the cortisol is the one that wreaks the most havoc because adrenaline comes in and it's out real quick. It's what gives us that burst of energy and strength so that we can deal with the emergency, and then it goes away. But the cortisol, once it gets released, it stays there for a long period of time. And in our very busy, hectic lifestyles, It's almost as if we're being chased by a tiger 24/7. We go into this hyper, vigilant state, release a lot of cortisol, and cortisol plays havoc on the immune system, and it damages some of these cells that control the balance and can lead to autoimmunity and inflammatory diseases. And again, I could spend 2 or 3 hours just talking about cortisol. Exercise is really important. Excessive exercise can contribute to inflammation. So, marathon training, which I love to do, probably not the best exercise because it contributes to inflammation. So if you're doing heavy-duty exercise and training, lots of heavy-duty weightlifting, marathon, triathlon, I'm not saying don't do it, but if you do, you have to really be careful that you're replenishing all of those antioxidants and eating a lot of really good anti-inflammatory foods and possibly taking herbs to help get the healing going all the time. Drinking turmeric in your water before and after exercise, ginger, eating lots of greens, drinking green juices to replenish all those minerals, that's going to help to counteract that. Not enough exercise. When you're sedentary, you don't move things enough, so your joints don't move. The blood doesn't flow as quickly. The blood is not as oxygenated as it needs to be. And so that affects the immune system, and thus it affects the inflammation in the system. And environmental exposures, I want to take just a couple of minutes to talk about that. There's a lot of studies with this. There's a lot of studies on the effects of mercury on the immune cells and how mercury attaches itself to some of the lymphocytes and then creates reactions. It attaches itself to tissue and then creates autoimmune reactions. Mercury has been implicated a lot in conditions like autism. And there's just a lot of research going on with that. It causes inflammation in the brain that then causes the improper firing of nerve cells and all that. So those are really important factors, and we could talk about that at length at another time. Somebody have a question? Okay, so just going back and summarizing, our immune system is, our reactivity to some of these things is established real early on. And it doesn't mean that it's basically we're doomed. It just means we have to work harder at it. So if we were not breastfed, if we were on antibiotics early in life, like the first 3 years in life, we're much more likely to develop an autoimmune or an allergic condition. And that's in the medical literature. If we have too clean of an environment, we can also more likely to develop allergies, because when we have kind of a dirty environment, we're always exposed to this bacteria or that. We get good bacteria, bad bacteria. Our body gets practice on differentiating early on. And a lot of the stuff that we get, a lot of the good bacteria that we get can come from produce that hasn't been washed. Well, our produce goes through lots and lots of chains and factories and trucks and people touching it between the time it gets picked and the time that we eat it. So, we kind of want to wash it off. So the ideal would be to grow as much as you can, buy it from local growers, and don't wash it. So if you've got a garden in your backyard and you've got fresh produce going in there, don't wash it before you eat it, because it's going to help your immune system if you've got some of those good bacteria in there. Of course, if you've got stray cats running through your yard, and then you may want to consider washing it. So, all right. So the dietary factors in managing inflammation. We talked already about fats. So the fats are, the good fats are the omega-3s, and to some extent the omega-6s, but we have to be really careful about the balance. Remember how we talked about if you have too much omega-6 compared to omega-3. The omega-6s are all over the place. They're in all the vegetable oils that you go to a restaurant and they cook stuff in. They're either cooking it in peanut oil or some kind of canola oil or just Wesson vegetable oil. It's a generic vegetable oil. Those oils have been heated at very high temperatures, often in excess of 400 degrees, and they've been refined. They are oxidized. They are not in any way, shape, or form in a condition that can help our bodies. They can only hurt our bodies. If we buy any of the oils that come in bottles that are clear and they're sitting on the shelf, most likely they are oxidized and they have free radicals in there, and they are going to contribute to inflammation rather than anti-inflammation. So when it comes to dietary fats, we really want to focus on getting our omega-6s just through whole foods that have fat in them. So some of our nuts and seeds, sesame seeds, sunflower seeds, macadamia nuts, almonds, good sources of omega-6s in their whole state. Once you create oils out of them, unless you're really, really careful about it, the oils are not helping. On the omega-3 side, we talked already about flax. I prefer whole flax seed to flax oil, but I still use flax oil on occasion. It makes a nice additive to a salad dressing. Hemp seed, again, I prefer the whole seed. Chia seed is my new favorite. It's just, I love it. It's filling. It provides lots of minerals, lots of omega-3s, lots of protein. It's a great addition to a smoothie. You can make puddings out of it. There's lots of things you can do with it. I included a chia pudding in the recipes book. What else? And pumpkin seeds. Pumpkin seeds are easy to sprinkle on salads, to eat plain, to make into wonderful pestos and pâtés. Those are good sources. The other thing I want to add, it's not an omega-3 fat, but it is something that helps omega-3 fats, is coconut. And a lot of people are pushing coconut oil. Again, I prefer the whole food. Yeah, there's some recipes I use coconut oil in. But if I'm going to recommend to somebody that therapeutically takes coconut to help with their fat metabolism, I'm going to recommend that they eat whole coconut. And that's either buying those young Thai coconuts that you can buy at the Asian markets, or a whole big coconut, the kind that I don't buy anymore because it takes too long to chase them around the garage with a hammer to try to get them open. But what I do get a lot of is this basically coconut butter, kind of like peanut butter, only it's coconut butter. It comes in a jar. You can get it at Whole Foods or you can order it online. And it's really, really good. And when you mix coconut oil with your omega-3 fats, it enhances that conversion. We go back to our chart where we go from alpha-linoleic acid to EPA. It increases the activity of that delta-6 desaturase by tenfold. Not doubling, not tripling, but by tenfold. So, in other words, if you eat some flax seeds and you get 10% of that that flax converted to EPA, you add coconut, you're going to get 10 times that amount. Okay, so say you eat 100 grams of fat, of EPA, and typically you would have alpha-linoleic acid in your flax, and you typically would get 10 of that, double that, times that by 10, you get 100 converted. Okay, so that's really, really good because it helps with anti-inflammation. Anything? Any other questions about that? Any issues, concerns? Okay.
EPA, Peter Marie.
What's that?
What does EPA stand for?
EPA, okay. That's another one of those big million-dollar words. Icosapentaenoic acid, pentaenoic acid. And basically, it's a longer chain. I mean, fats are just chains of carbons and hydrogens and oxygens. And when you, the conversion is just basically making them longer. You don't need to know about its chemistry. But EPA is I put EPA because EPA is the word that you'll see. You know, oh, yeah, you got to get your EPA. Now, a lot of people will say you have to get your EPA from fish, and because flax is not very well converted. And in my experience, it's not very well converted because we don't have enough of those cofactors. Remember the vitamin B3 and B6 and zinc and vitamin C and magnesium. We don't have enough of those to be able to make that conversion. So in cases where people have a lot of inflammation and we want to get it under control quickly, and I do one of those fatty acid tests on them, and we find that their inflammation markers are way out of control, I will recommend that they take some fish oil if they're open to it short term, because that's going to give them the fastest results. But at the same time, what they're doing is feeding that whole cycle so that they don't have to take fish oil. Fish itself has got lots of mercury in it, so it's not recommended to have it more than once or twice a week. But the fish oil is it's very expensive. It's hard to get good fish oil that doesn't taste kind of rancid, and you know, so it's not something you don't necessarily want to just take for the rest of your life. It's a big expense. If you can fix it by eating good, solid, whole, raw nuts and seeds, you're even better off. But short term, as kind of a therapeutic pharmaceutical approach, rather than giving him pain medication, I would recommend somebody to take fish oil for their pain until we get the rest of it under control. Antioxidants, we talked about that before. Antioxidants are abundant in fresh fruits and vegetables. Okay, it's just loaded with it. Minerals. Minerals are one of the things that we are depleted in as a society. I would say that probably, I would say maybe 18 out of 20 people that I test for minerals are deficient. That's a lot. Okay? The main minerals that I see deficient are zinc, magnesium, and potassium. These minerals are abundant in our green foods, but we have to eat significant amounts of them. This is where I recommend people drink green smoothies, where they take a bunch of greens, they blend them up with a bunch of fruit, throw them in the blender, make a delicious drink, add some ginger, add some turmeric if you want, take it down. Get a really good antioxidant-rich, anti-inflammatory drink. And then you get enough of the greens. And, you know, we have a whole course in greens. We're going to be doing another green cleanse in May. If you want more information about that, you can go to my website and download. There's a link for a presentation that was done, an interview with me and Victoria Batenko. It talks a lot about the greens, and you can download that course if you want as well for more information. But just include a green smoothie or a green soup or some kind of blended greens on a daily basis. And include some sea vegetables in there because those are high in minerals, and that's going to help with the inflammation. Vitamins. Your main vitamins for inflammation are your B vitamins and your vitamin C. And interesting enough, going back to the stress connection, vitamin C is the tissue in the body that uses the most vitamin C is the adrenal gland. You use a tremendous amount of vitamin C when you're under stress. You use a tremendous amount of the B vitamins when you're under stress because they modulate the neurotransmitters. Do you see how it's all coming together? Is it coming together?
Yes.
Do I still have you here? I know it's a lot of information, but trust me, it really does make sense to know this stuff. Because when I say eat lots of fruits and vegetables, then you know, oh, well, it affects this and affects that. And even if you don't remember the names of it, you're going to have this remembrance that, wow, it's more than just, wow, they're just good for me. It's affecting all these different parts of your body. Food allergens we touched on earlier with the gluten and the casein, but it's not limited just to gluten and casein. You could be allergic to anything, and it has to do with the state of your immune system and that whole, you know, self versus non-self recognition and friend versus foe recognition. So if your body, for some reason, because the immune system is altered and out of control, decides that broccoli protein is foe, you're going to have antibodies to it. And every time you eat broccoli, you're going to have an inflammatory response. And that's not good, because we're usually eating broccoli because it's so high in all these cancer-fighting chemicals and all these antioxidants, and it's just a wonderful food. But if every time you eat it, you get inflammation, even if it's silent inflammation that's inside, that's not good. So a lot of times what people do is they really focus on food allergies. It's like, okay, I'm allergic to this, 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 and this, and they have a list of about five foods that they can eat. And you know what happens? They start to eat those five foods, and after a few months, they get allergic to those five foods. Any idea why? Well, I'll tell you why. The reason is that the reason that they had all those food allergies in the first place was because their digestive tract lining was compromised. And there's inflammation in there. And the cells aren't preventing some of these antibodies from going into the bloodstream. And the immune system is confused and it's not recognizing friend and foe adequately. So what happens is when they go off of all those foods that they were allergic to, then they get new allergies because now the body's eating, you're eating those five foods over and over again. You haven't fixed the cause, which is the inflamed or leaky gut, and you get other food allergies. So really the underlying cause of all this is fixing the inflammation. Okay. Does that make sense? Chemicals. We talked about those already. We want to avoid as much as possible pesticides. If you haven't already done so, I may have it in the handout, and if not, I'll add it to the handout. The list of the 12 foods that have the highest pesticide residues. If you can't buy those foods organically grown, I recommend that you don't buy them. And among those are grapes and strawberries and celery and I can't remember all of them. I think red bell peppers are in there. There's a bunch of them that have the highest levels of pesticide residues. And they use the most pesticides because, like, strawberries are very delicate. So I would recommend you don't eat those unless you can get them organically grown. On the other foods, if you can't get them organic or if the budget is a concern, then, you know, just go with sticking to those 12. But the other thing is chemicals come in processed food. So any idea how many chemicals are in Twinkies? I mean, there's a boatload of them. And any idea how many chemicals are in the bread that they serve over at that Subway? They have that whole wheat bread that they serve there, supposed to be healthy. I got the list of the ingredients on that, and it's got probably 20 or 30 ingredients, and most of them I can't pronounce. Okay. Chemicals coming into our body all the time. What does it do when it, you know, we start out with this immune system that goes friend or foe. You know, it was kind of programmed to recognize food and bacteria and organisms, and all of a sudden we're bombarded with these chemicals that don't occur in nature. And we don't have mechanisms for handling them. So they get stored here, they get stored there, and they cause, you know, chronic inflammation and alteration of the immune system. So as much as you can, stay away from chemicals. And that's just not in the food. It's in your cosmetics as well. Read the stuff before you put it on your skin, because there's chemicals in there and there's other things that just, you know, are not meant to be in your body. And our skin is another organ of ingestion, basically. We know that because there's nicotine patches and estrogen patches. So we know that things get through the skin. So why would we think that we could, you know, use a cosmetic product on our skin, some skin lotion that has, you know, 14 chemicals that we can't pronounce, that, you know, some of them that are suspected carcinogens, some of them that are known, and some of them that have antifreeze in them. And we put that on our skin and expect that not to get into our system. So as we move more and more into this anti-inflammatory lifestyle, we need to make choices. And don't overwhelm yourself by going home and throwing everything out all at once. You know, just make a decision that you're going to just look and each week you're going to get rid of one thing and pull another thing in, and do it in a pace that you can handle. Because otherwise you get too stressed, and then you counteract your great, you know, diet and cleanup job by spewing cortisol into your system. Does that make sense? Any questions on the anti-inflammatory foods? Okay, I'm going to have a list a little bit further down so you can have access to that. Okay, so specifically in the anti-inflammatory foods, fruits, berries are one of your best antioxidants. Grapes, one of your best antioxidants and anti-inflammatories. In the vegetables, all the greens are your best choices there. On the condiment side, we already talked about ginger, turmeric, garlic, black pepper even, really good. On the nut side, walnuts have more omega-3 than any other nut. On the seed side, we've already talked about that. The anti-inflammatory seeds would be your chia, hemp, pumpkin, and flax. And these are the ones I'm going to have in that other chart, so you don't have to worry about writing all those down. I have a chart with all those in it. Okay. Grains, your non-gluten grains can be anti-inflammatory. Now, that is only if you don't have a problem with insulin resistance. And how do you know if you have a problem with insulin resistance? Well, measure your waist, measure your hip. If you're a man and they're... The difference between them, or they're equal, or the waist is bigger than the hip, you know you have insulin resistance. In a woman, your hips should be at least 50% greater than your... So, for example, 50%, what am I saying? So, say, for example, your waist measures 30 inches, and your hips measure 32 inches, you probably have insulin resistance. But if your hips measure 40 inches and your waist measures 20 inches, you probably don't have insulin resistance. So it's the difference between them. And I think it's 75%. Your waist should be no more than 75% of your hips. So that's a good sign. And if you have insulin resistance, I highly recommend that you stay off of grains for a while until your body can get that under control. Because if you can't get the insulin and the blood sugar balance under control, you're not going to get the inflammation under control. And on the legume side, some of them are acid forming and some of them are not. The lentils tend to be the ones that, and the mung beans and adjiki beans tend to be the more anti-inflammatory and alkaline forming. Okay. I'm going to give you a list of anti-inflammatory herbs. I didn't have the opportunity to finish typing it last night, but I will get that in the next thing. So I'm going to go through some of them. We already talked about ginger and turmeric, which are part of the food kind of things, foods that you would eat. Some of the other herbs that are not necessarily things that we would have in our kitchen, but we can. Well, green tea is another anti-inflammatory. But some of the other ones that we don't necessarily have in our kitchen but can be used therapeutically in making teas and tinctures, skullcap, feverfew, holy basil. Nettle is another one that can be done as a food. You can get nettle seed. That's the stinging nettle plant. Amazing anti-inflammatory, antioxidant, and high mineral content food. And that's something you can make a tea out of. You can sprinkle it in your smoothies. You could put it into soups. You could put it into stews. You could make nut and seed pâtés out of that and put nettles in there. Excellent. Some of the other spices that you'll have in your kitchen that are good anti-inflammatories are oregano, rosemary. Some of the others that are not necessarily anti-inflammatory, these guys, most of these guys are COX-2 inhibitors that we talked about before. They actually really have a therapeutic effect on reducing that cyclooxygenase enzyme. Some of the others are good because they're more soothing, they're more demulcent, especially if you've got...
Can you get them to put aloe vera on it?
Sorry. So they're soothing. They've got a soothing effect on the GI tract, a soothing effect on the mucous membranes in your throat and in the respiratory tract, like licorice, slippery elm, cat's claw. Probiotics can be anti-inflammatory because they help to establish the flora in the gut. Okay. There are other natural products that are used for healing that are just not necessarily stuff that you get easy access to or that you would get as a food, that you would eat as a food or a tea, but that you could take as supplements, but that help with joint, more like joint healing, which would be glucosamine and chondroitin. We talked about fish oils. And also essential oils can be used, and you can use those topically if you've got skin irritation, or you can use them in an aromatherapy way. Volatile oils that come off of them, black pepper, lavender, lemongrass, and rosemary. Okay, in your chart on page 8 is a list of inflammatory foods. I think we've talked them to death pretty much, but these are the foods that if you're still eating any of these foods, you need to start eliminating them, and you need to do it quickly, or otherwise you're just going to have this inflammation that goes on and on. Okay, and if you don't have an inflammatory condition right now, you're going to get one. And you may have one that's internal that you don't know about. And a good screening test for that is that test I talked about earlier, which is the balance, the omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids. And it's a little test that's very easy to do. It's a little pricey, not too bad. It's a little over $100. And you prick your skin on the finger. You put a little drop of blood on a little plate. You send it into the lab, and they analyze it for somewhere between 9 and 12 fats. And it tells you what your balance is. So are you high in omega-3s, omega-9s, which ones? And it gives you an idea of which foods you can then do to modulate that. So if you have some kind of inflammatory or autoimmune disease, it's a great test to have that information. If you don't have that, your numbers are out of balance, you want to get them in balance, or else it means that you're removing yourself there. Do you have any questions on that? We have another 10 minutes left, and we're pretty much close to the end. Okay, the last thing I wanted to talk about, and then did somebody have a question? Wanted to hold that question for just a minute. I'll talk about this. This is a real brief thing, and then you can ask that question. It's basically the inflammatory ratings of foods. There's a book that I found. I have downloaded a copy of it, but I haven't read through it completely. But what I liked was the chapter that they had. It's called The Inflammation free diet plan, and I have the list of that reference there. And what she came up with was this thing called the inflammatory rating of foods. Well, lots of us have heard about the glycemic index of foods. This is another way of rating foods to give us an idea of is it going to be good for our body. And anti-inflammatory foods have a positive IF rating, and inflammatory foods have a negative IF rating. And I've got in the recipe guide and the shopping list, I've got a list of these foods. I'm just taking, she has a list of 1,600, so I'm going through the book and I'm taking out just, you know, the most common ones and maybe create a chart of 40 or 50 different foods to give you an idea of the rating. So some foods might be very inflammatory, some foods might be just moderately inflammatory, some foods might be very anti-inflammatory, like, for example, cherries have an inflammatory rating of 600, which is, like, super anti-inflammatory, compared to, what was one that had a really, I think it was, like, steak had something like minus 250. So it gives you an idea of what you're eating and how much inflammation is in there. Okay? So we've covered a lot. I hope that it's been informative, and I want to address any questions that you have. And I offered you to the first 15 people who signed up, and you'll be getting a notice, that we can have a question and answer call in a couple of weeks, and then we can address things that are more specific for you. Like if I've got a such and such disease, and I'm doing this and this, how, you know, what other kinds of things can I do? So this is, now is not the time for that kind of the very personal questions, but those questions can be answered on that call in a couple of weeks. But for now, what I wanted to do is address any general questions. We have about 5 minutes left. I think it was a Trixie that had a question?
Trixie. Well, on your inflammatory food list, you had fruit juice, choose the fruit instead. What about these new drinks that are coming out that are like goji and noni and, you know,
the kind of therapeutic ones?
Yeah. Where do they fall?
You know, some of those are really high quality, and they have just the juice that they claim they have. So if it says noni on it, it just has noni. Some of them are 75% pasteurized apple juice.
Uh-huh.
All right? So what the problem with that, now noni and goji are not highly sweet fruits. When you drink apple juice, it's like drinking pure sugar, especially if it's pasteurized. Even if it's not, but when it's pasteurized, you're drinking pure sugar, basically. So you need to just kind of evaluate those on a basis. Yes, I haven't really done much research on the values of those. They are pasteurized, although one is cold processed. I think there's one brand of the goji that is cold processed, in which case I would say that that's perfectly fine. And if you're going to be drinking any kind of fruit juice like that, you should be doing it with greens. So make yourself some green juice or add it to a green smoothie or do something where you've got a lot of minerals to help that sugar to be metabolized adequately.
Thank you.
Sure. Anybody else have questions?
What about acaya? The juice of berries from the Amazon or something?
Again, I haven't really researched it that much. It's got a lot of great claims to it. They usually sell it frozen. I've seen it in jars, and I've seen it frozen. I believe it is pasteurized, although the frozen one is probably not. It's probably fresh frozen. And again, I don't know. I mean, in general, fruit juices are not good, but there's, like I said, I call them therapeutic fruit juices. I'd have to do more research on that. I really don't know.
Thanks.
Any other questions?
It's Trixie again.
Yes.
You talked about supplementing with vitamin C, that we needed vitamin C, and if we needed to supplement with it, which form of vitamin C do you recommend, or is that an individual recommendation?
That's a great question, and yeah, you know, we really want to, you know, in theory, we want to get everything from our foods. In practicality,
yeah.
We've gotten so far out of balance that it would take a whole boatload of food to make up some of the deficiencies, right? So you can do whole food forms of vitamin C. There's a really nice supplement that's got spirulina and amla fruit. And it doesn't have, like, really high therapeutic doses of vitamin C, but it's a nice background dose. when I'm working with people with really out of control autoimmune and inflammatory conditions, I usually do put them on a vitamin C supplement. And there's controversy over that, whether you know, I'd be better off with the, you know, concentrated goji juice or some of the other berries that have high levels, the cherries and stuff. But I know that I can get a very good effect with people with allergies if I get them on high doses of a powdered, fully buffered mineral ascorbate. And I can get good results with that, and I haven't had people, I could say to somebody, well, I haven't tried it, but if you want to try this whole food, I don't know what the dose should be, but let's experiment with it. They're going, you know what, why don't you find somebody else to experiment with, because if you know that you can get my allergies under control that way, I think I'd rather go that way. So I'm looking for a group of people who may want to experiment with that, with allergies or some kind of condition where we can figure out what the proper dosage is of that vitamin C or food base. You're going to get lots of vitamin C when you're doing lots of fresh foods, but that said, it may not be enough, depending on what your condition is at this point. But I like to think that for maintenance, you know, that the strongest supplement we might need is something like a spirulina or a fruit powder, you know, which gives us lots of concentrated nutrients. Like, I'm trying to get balance between, you know, what makes sense theoretically and what makes sense practically.
Okay, thank you.
Did that answer your question?
I was looking at ascorbic acid, and then there's sodium ascorbate.
The one in particular. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of them out there, and the one in particular that I like because they it's fully reduced. It's the only one that says it's fully reduced, which means you get the full antioxidant effect of it because they do it in a vacuum. And it's a company called PERQ, P-E-R-Q-U-E, and they're available. You can get them online at EmersonEcologics.com, or you could get them at, what's that name of that? People's Pharmacy here in Austin carries it. But I like that brand, and I've seen really good results with that brand. It is fully buffered, and it's a balanced buffer. It doesn't have too much magnesium. Some of the buffered ones may have too much magnesium, and it causes diarrhea before you get to the bowel tolerance of vitamin C. Mm-hmm. We can talk about more about that if you have any more questions in the follow-up call.
Thank you. Okay.
Sure. Any other questions?
Rita Marie?
Yeah.
This is Pamela, and I just had a question. Somebody else mentioned fibromyalgia earlier. Is that among the inflammatory disorders?
Yes. And let me talk briefly about that. That is definitely an inflammatory disorder. The reason it doesn't have an itis, because it could have an itis at the end, is that alga at the end means pain. And fibromyalgia is a condition where it is an inflammation of the connective tissues, and so we have this pain that's throughout our body. And it's usually at very specific points. It seems to be a pattern of points, but it's definitely inflammation of those tissues. And it's very commonly linked to inflammation in the gut as a preceding cause of it.
Okay.
And it fits into this mold, this model, anti-inflammatory. A therapy that would be geared towards anti-inflammatory.
I'm just hearing more and more about this and running into more and more people that have fibromyalgia.
Yep, it's kind of like a modern-day epidemic. And, you know, inflammatory diseases are epidemic these days. And when you look around and see what people are eating mainly inflammatory foods. They are under stress. They are not exercising. We are bombarded with fear on the news. You know, we're not greeted on the news with, well, everybody, take a nice deep breath and let's appreciate the day. Let me tell you all the nice things that happened. You know, Mary Smith had a baby, and you know, that's not what we're hit with. And in the news today, no, hot breaking news, and it, you know, just the sound of the voice, and even for me just now repeating that, my whole body got all tense and stressed out about it. So we're bombarded with things that are inflammatory. And it's no wonder that fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, asthma is an inflammatory condition, gastritis, colitis, inflammatory bowel disease. And if you have alternating constipation and diarrhea, even if it's really not severe, you're on your way to inflammatory bowel disease. And that's, again, an autoimmune disease. That's if the body's attacking the tissue in the gut, in the intestine. And you can have ulcerative colitis or Crohn's, depending on where it's at. So. Okay, I have time for one last question, and then we'll wrap it up. Anyone? Okay. Well, I want to thank you all for being on the call tonight. I hope I didn't overwhelm you too much with information. It's always hard to distinguish how much information to give versus glossing it over. I don't like to just gloss it over because I want it to have an impact. I want you to know that this is it's a complex problem with a relatively simple solution. It may not be simple in that you do this and you're immediately well, but I have had people who have gone on an anti-inflammatory diet and called me in 3 days and go, my joint pains are about half of what they were 3 days ago. Can that be possible? I said, yes, it can. It can when you take out the insults. Okay? So think about it. Start to look at, you know, incorporating more and more anti-inflammatory foods in your diet. And I'll talk to you in a few weeks. And I will be getting back to you by email and let you know when the follow-up question and answer call is. Expect to get an email from me sometime tomorrow and have the rest of these files loaded on here and maybe some other goodies that I can come up with.
Super. Thank you very, very much.
You're very welcome.
Thanks.
Have a good night.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.